Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. The 69th Primetime Emmy Awards are this weekend. To celebrate, we're going to look back at two of our favorite episodes featuring nominated actors. First up, Angela Bassett. She's nominated for Best Guest Actress in a Comedy Series for her role as Catherine in the Netflix show Master of None. Here's Angela reading Marcia De Sanctis' essay, What the Psychic Knew.
Years ago, panicked, on the cusp of 30, between jobs and wondering where life would take me, I consulted a psychic. I remember staring at the sea of green carpet in her home as she addressed the usual concerns. She told me to marry Mark, the man I was living with, that I would have a son and a daughter, and that my future with them would not be in New York City, contrary to what I had long assumed. Finally, I asked the question I really wanted answered. When will I die? That's not what I do, she said. So I can't say. You can't? Because you don't know, or because it's bad? She tilted her head to one side. Can you tell me how, then? I see a severe blow to the head, she said. Catching me squarely in the eyes, it will be sudden, and you won't feel pain. That's a relief, I said. I was born with a death sentence. Like every creature that walks the earth, but I instantly regretted having this expertise into how I would leave it. But here's what I can say about this life, she continued, referring presumably to the time before I would be killed by a foul ball at Fenway Park or a tree branch in the woods. Your purpose is love. As opposed to what? She shrugged. Power, money, great acclaim. Too bad, I said. We chatted for another minute until our time was up. I took the cassette from the recorder and stuffed it into my pocket and wrote her a check for $150. I admit that at times her insight had kept me on easy company and on high alert. For example, I never drive behind a truck carting things that might slip off at high speed. A decade later, the psychic was 3 for 3. I lived with my husband Mark and my son and daughter away from New York City, but the part about my purpose being love had been sidelined, or so I thought. Once the power vacuum of middle age descended, sucking the youth from my body, my spirit, and my marriage, everything I had to give went to my children. And though I loved them and my husband utterly, the drudgery of the day-to-day made it seem as if not love, but coffee, my Toyota, and sheer logistics were what propelled me through life. At 45, I had a hip operation, and the following 8 weeks gave me a brief window into old age. The view was not good. My family soldiered through a long winter with me hobbling. We all needed to get away. So I booked a few days at a seaside room in Miami with one king-size bed, my kids, then 8 and 11, and I arrived to glorious Florida blue skies. That first day, the sun knocked the kids out early and they fell asleep on either side of me in the sprawling bed, their shoulders already browned up and still smelling of sunscreen. I had dropped 15 pounds after my operation, and since I wasn't too fleshy to begin with, the loss made me look more haggard than I felt. I tried to right my pajama bottoms that had twisted around me, and as I did, I became aware of something in my abdomen, a lump that obviously didn't belong there. It was firm and round as a new summer plum. The warmest calm fell over me, and I grabbed my children, who rustled as I pulled them close. Back home, the doctor sent me to the hospital immediately with a good luck, delivered in the gravest of tones. There, I saw many of the same nurses who had cared for me 3 months before. They asked, what was I doing there? I have a lump in my belly, I said. Lying on the gurney, stuck up with needles, I was wholly, entirely unafraid. My husband ran into the room, his face clouded with confusion. If this is cancer, I'm toast, I said. It's not cancer, he said. Four doctors appeared at my bedside. What's going on? My husband asked. Do you know what it is? The youngest one sat too gently on the foot of my bed. We haven't identified it yet, but we know the mass is in your liver. Can you just tell me if I have cancer? I said. I cannot tell you that you don't, he said. We'll take more tests tomorrow. Please, try to get some rest. What is your sense? I asked. He shook his head. I thought his face answered for him. When the doctors left, I began to rattle off instructions to Mark, as if dictating a grocery list. The transition team, for when I died, was to be headed by my friend Sarah. She understands the culture of our house, so she has to be very involved with the kids. Will you stop it? He said. It's important that they still get the same birthday cakes, I said. That lemon cake for Ray. Ava's vanilla with pink butter frosting. The Thanksgiving recipes. Nana Foley's stuffing. It's all about food, really, and Sarah gets this. You're being crazy, Mark said, holding my hand. The mass inside me felt alive, as if its dark center contained the heartbeat in my slackened body. You have to get married right away, I said. I would handpick my replacement, the woman who would be the new cornerstone of our home. You know who I really like? I asked. Enough, he said. If you're sick, you'll fight it. Why am I not afraid? I asked, fogging out with painkillers. I knew the answer. As with the psychic's prediction, what scared me most was not knowing how anything ever would unfold. From aging, to anguish about my children, to possibly facing my husband's eventual illness or death, the mysteries of the second half of my life loomed ever closer, and it was terrifying. It was definitely a cop-out, but for the first time in years, I felt as if I knew where I was going, and I could stop waiting for all manner of blunt instruments to crash through my windshield. I watched Mark's face through drugged eyes. He sat awake all night in our room as I drifted in and out of lucidity. Time had attempted to obscure, or at least to trivialize, our deep history. But somewhere in that haze, I sensed in him the antidote to my fear, not of death, but of life. I extended my arms at my sides, and they ached with a craving to hold my children, as I had done only days before in Florida. I imagined them sleeping, their little arms curled around nothing but air. I imagined them sleeping. Their little arms curled around nothing but air. At 5 a.m., Mark went out for coffee, and 4 hours later, they discovered that the clementine-sized mass cocooned in my liver was benign. The next morning, a laparoscope siphoned it from my body, and the surgeon stitched up the incisions. Mark and I arrived home, and the children, who had been staying at Sarah's, soon followed. They were still brown as biscuits from Miami. My little girl looked wary. She had seen me too fragile too often that winter. I wanted to tell her, tell them all, how sorry I was, because I knew that for those moments it wasn't courage, but cowardice that had given me no fear of dying. A week later, I blew the dust off a box. Inside, I found the tape labeled August 1990. My car had the only cassette player, so I went for a drive and waited for the echo of my younger voice, then the psychic's. She spoke of my future son and daughter. Then there was a strange silence after I pushed her to reveal how I would die. And at last, her finale, that love would be the driving force of my life. Isn't that kind of obvious? I asked. Is it? Wait until you ask yourself, now what? You'll see. She was right. I had seen.
Angela Bassett, reading Marcia De Sanctis's essay, What the Psychic Knew. If you want to hear an update from Marcia, go to wbur.org/modernlove. You can also go to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher and listen to episode 34. Up next, Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. ABC's Modern Family is nominated for Best Comedy Series at this year's Emmys. Jesse Tyler Ferguson plays Mitchell on that show. He reads Jerry Mahoney's essay, Mom, Not Mom, Aunt.
After five loving, fulfilling years with my boyfriend, Drew, I suddenly found myself online looking to meet a woman. I spent hours poring over profiles, bios, and stats, looking at poorly lighted digital pictures and videos of awkward faces uttering tightly rehearsed self-promotional pitches. I narrowed the flash mob of candidates to six. Then I summoned Drew for his approval. Together, we had a decision to make. One of the strangers on this website could end up contributing half of our child's DNA. Big nose, bad hair, gross skin. Oh, those eyebrows. Drew sped down the list and blackballed them all. I fought for a few, but she has a 4.0 at veterinary school, and this one teaches autistic kids to tap dance. Drew was unmoved. I shouldn't have been surprised. As a writer, I'm drawn to characters with intriguing quirks and heart-tugging backstories. But for Drew, who spent 12 years overseeing reality programming for MTV, this was proving just to be another casting decision, albeit for the significant supporting role of egg donor. We'd been instructed by our surrogacy agency not to use the M word. This child will have two fathers, the staff member scolded. He or she will have an egg donor and a surrogate, but no mother. whatever you call these young women, there's no shortage of them. For all those who are desperate to stop gay couples from adopting, there are others who are eager to help us down a more complex path to parenthood. And for the most part, they are merely girls, some as young as 19, still in their awkward phases. You click on a face, and up pops a video in which an acne-cheeked college sophomore talks about her poli-sci major, her love of soccer and One Tree Hill, and eyes wide with optimism about the corporation she'll be running in 5 years. Drew and I found each other, via similar means, an online dating site. We used a kind of systemized vetting that, these days, takes the place of destiny. Drew screened out the guys who liked house music or who mixed up your and your. I vetoed anyone who, in place of a headshot, uploaded a crotch shot. Choosing a biological relative for our unborn fetus wasn't going to be as simple. There were so many more variables and bigger questions to ponder. Most candidates requested the standard $8,000 fee, but some negotiated their own rates. If she was blonde, athletic, and Harvard-educated, she thought she was worth 30 grand. Everybody wants their children to have the best. But this process threatened to bankrupt us, even without all the premium options. Besides, who knew what that money would really buy? If we picked someone with an astronomical price tag, couldn't we be saddling our child with the greed gene? And how would we explain it to him? Your egg donor was the top of the line, son. We got you, and she got a Porsche. Or, we wanted you to be taller, but anything over 5'9" was out of our price range. For us, two men who struggle over which Netflix movie to watch, this decision could stretch on long after our biological clocks had run out. That's when Susie called. You know you can have my eggs if you want them, right? She said. It was that swift, that casual. As if we were talking about borrowing her hairdryer or Ani DeFranco CDs rather than part of her womanhood. But with that simple statement, it got even more complicated. Susie was everything an egg donor should be. Kind, beautiful, smart, a gifted artist, and at 28, practically at the peak of her fertility. She was also Drew's little sister. Despite being 9 years apart in age and on opposite sides of the country, Susie and Drew couldn't be closer or more alike. They talk on the phone nearly every day, make the same facial expressions, laugh at the same dirty jokes, have the same mercurial temper. With Susie's offer, I knew generosity was yet another trait they shared. All along, Drew and I had wondered whose sperm would we use. With Susie, the matter was settled. I would be the biological father. Yet, for the first time, Drew and I were also able to imagine what it would be like to have a child who had genetic roots in both family trees. What would she look like? How would he act? How would our respective features merge into one warbling little miracle? We'd grown up when coming out meant putting an end to dreams of fatherhood. Now we were giddy with the possibilities of reproduction that most straight couples take for granted. But what exactly would Susie be sacrificing? She was young and unattached. She wanted her own children but wasn't ready. So was she prepared for someone else to have her child? And how would she explain this particular brand of baggage to a potential husband someday? Most of all, would she be satisfied always being Aunt Susie to this child and never, you know, the M word? Drew and I had doubts, but Susie considered it a done deal. This was her brother, and if he needed eggs, damn it, he was going to take hers. She was as stubborn as Drew would have been if he were offering and she were the one in need. She didn't flinch when the doctor explained the pain and inconvenience she would endure before her eggs were extracted. Months of genetic tests, weeks of hormone injections, and the resultant mood swings. Most troubling of all, she'd need so much time off she could risk losing her job. To all of this, she shrugged and asked only one question. When do we start? When the day of the extraction finally came, the hard part was supposed to be over. With the right dose of medication, most women Susie's age produce dozens of healthy eggs. But for reasons the doctor couldn't explain, Susie produced only 5. Of those, 2 failed to fertilize. The outlook was bad for us, devastating for Susie. The physician spoke about her fertility the way Al Gore describes polar ice caps. Time is running out, and it may already be too late. He warned that if our surrogate couldn't become pregnant with Susie's eggs, it was unlikely Susie ever would either. We all agreed the only option was to implant the 3 embryos and begin an excruciating wait. If this didn't work, Drew and I would return to the websites full of strangers, if we even had the strength to try again. And we didn't want to think about what that would mean for Susie. 10 days later, we were visiting Drew's family in upstate New York. It was 2 days before Christmas, and we were all trying our best to talk about anything but babies. My cell phone rang, and a hush fell over the room. The nurse on the other end didn't stall. "Jerry," she squealed, "I have some exciting news." A cascade of cheers drowned out the rest of the call, and Susie, Drew, and I shared a tight hug that seemed to last for hours. A few weeks later, we joined our surrogate for her first ultrasound, where an even bigger surprise awaited. From the grainy soup on the sonogram monitor, 2 peanut shapes emerged. Drew and I were going to be the fathers of twins. Our son and daughter are now 10 months old, and when I look at them, I see traces of each of us. My nose, Susie's eyes, Drew's chin. They're just starting to invent a secret language to communicate with each other. If we hear one baby cry, it's a safe bet that the other just stole her pacifier or hit him with a stuffed monkey. But then, when no one's looking, sometimes they'll reach out and hold each other's hands. Susie gets to witness it all, because her frequent phone calls with Drew have become video chats with our whole family. And as I watch Drew proudly showing off our children for her, I realize the gift Susie has given us is much more valuable than just a genetic link to our offspring. It's a brother and a sister. Tiny. Perfect. And gradually building a special bond all their own.
Jesse Tyler Ferguson of Modern Family, reading Jerry Mahoney's essay, Mom, Not Mom, Aunt. To hear our interview with Jerry and with Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, visit our website, wbur.org/modernlove.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Next week, Carrie Bechet from AMC's Halt and Catch Fire.
Why do we send flowers? To make up for what is intangible? Those feelings we can't hold in our hands and present as a gift to our loved ones? And why is it that the placeholders we choose, the dozen red roses, the fragrant white lilies, the long-stemmed French tulips, why is it that they are so fleeting? Hold on to them for too long, and you end up with a mess of petals, pollen, and foul-smelling water.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.